Hello and welcome to Greatest Britons. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Today is our fourth and final episode on Robert Blatchford, and I will, as always, be joined by my co-host, Max Musson, from Western Spring. Well, shall we get into our Greatest Britons then, Max?
Yes, let's do that.
Okay, I think we might actually finish with Robert Blatchford today. We've finished off with the quotes from Merry England, and we'll get back to talking about Robert Blatchford's life. And we got up to just about during the war, and in his articles during the war, Blatchford campaigned for better pay for the soldiers and considerable pensions for disabled soldiers, soldiers' widows and children. When a soldier wrote to him claiming his opinions would not be accepted by the army, but those of Philip Snowden and Ramsay MacDonald would, Blatchford replied, "I'm sorry, I cannot help it. You want peace, but you cannot have peace without victory. The struggle with Germany will not end with the present war, and we may someday have to fight Germany single-handed." And remember, that was the First World War that he was talking about there. So he's actually sort of presaging the Second World War. So he knew more about this than Rudyard Kipling did, I think. He seems to understand things a little bit better. Would that be right, Max?
Well, my feelings are that Robert Blatchford seemed to change his opinion on a number of things as he got older. And he's most famous, as we've already discussed, for the efforts that he put into the founding of the Labour Party and the Clarion Group, etc. During those earlier periods, he espoused a form of socialism which I would describe as being a nationalist form of socialism, or national socialism, depending on how you want to describe it. That situation in terms of his opinion on politics seemed to persist until we started to get into the 30s and the 40s, where his political opinions started to change. And what we don't bear in mind quite often is that he was born in 1851, which meant he was already 49 at the turn of the 20th century. And so when you look at the Second World War, he was already 88 when the Second World War started. He would have been roughly 20 years younger, obviously, when the First World War started. And I think that with age, Robert Blatchford's analytical abilities started to diminish. And so he says things which I don't think are consistent with his earlier beliefs. And he holds opinions which aren't necessarily national socialistic, and which tend to be more jingoistic. He seems to be more influenced by the jingoistic nature of the press than his own sort of analysis of politics.
I think it's interesting. He says you cannot have peace without victory, and he was assured of the fact that, you know, Britain must be the guys in charge. If it's not the British in charge, then, you know, who do you think else is going to be good enough to run things? So he certainly believed in himself. Unfortunately, Blatchford's wife died in 1921, and in 1923 he would write in response to claims in the press that he had been converted away from socialism by reading Henry Ford's autobiography that, quote, "I have never been converted from socialism, but careful observation of the facts for the last 12 years or so has convinced me that socialism will not work. And a study of Mr. Ford's methods has provided what seems to me as good a substitute as we may hope in this imperfect world. Socialism as I knew it in past years was an excellent, almost a perfect theory. The golden rule will not work in international politics because the nations are not good enough to live up to it. Real socialism strongly resembles real Christianity. It is a council of perfection and cannot be adopted and adhered to by our imperfect humanity. There is nothing the matter with socialism, but the people are neither wise enough nor good enough to make it a success. Socialism implies the self-abnegation of the individual for the good of the community." And that's nationalism, isn't it, really? The self-abnegation of the individual for the good of the nation. So you can see there the link that there is between nationalism and socialism. And I'm also intrigued by the fact that he was impressed with Henry Ford. And I wonder whether he read any of Henry Ford's other works in the Dearborn Independent. Do you know anything about that, Max, about his views on Henry Ford?
Yeah, he read some of the ideas of Henry Ford, and Henry Ford was somebody who's renowned as having been a capitalist, but he was also a socialist in many ways. And I think that the distinction we have to draw here between socialism and Marxism, or socialism and communism, is that communism and Marxism are forms of socialism. I mean, socialism just means an organized society. And so having an organized society, it can't be regarded as being a good or a bad thing, unless you're an anarchist, I suppose, and you don't believe in any kind of organization for society. But for most people, having some kind of an organized society is a good thing. And Blatchford's earlier socialism was socialism insofar as he saw it orientated around the needs of the nation. And I think that if you have socialism orientated around the needs of the nation, then socialism can work. I think that where Blatchford's tends to move away from socialism and towards Ford's ideas are where he starts to confuse or starts to view socialism only as either communism or Marxism, or some kind of happy clappy kumbaya kind of humanist socialism of the sort that is, you know, often espoused by people on the left who have no real sort of conception of what governing a nation is all about. But as far as Henry Ford is concerned, Henry Ford introduced what was regarded as welfare capitalism into the United States. I don't know whether he was the first person to do that, but that's certainly something that he did. And what Henry Ford did was comparable to what a number of Quaker families did over here in the UK, which such as Cadbury's, for example. Cadbury's created the Bourneville Village, which was near their chocolate producing plant in just outside Birmingham. And, you know, the Bourneville chocolate bar is named after Bourneville Village. And what you found in Bourneville was that the Cadbury family had decided that if they wanted their workers to work happily and to give their best in terms of producing as high a quality of product as possible and as great a volume of the product as possible, then they needed to look after their workers, and they needed to have a paternalist approach to looking after their workers. And so they created what was like an idyllic village or small town of Bourneville, where the properties were inhabited solely by their workers. And so there was no worries about whether their workers could afford to live near the factory, because Cadbury's actually made them houses so they could. So it was a definite that yes, they could. And there were all sorts of other things that helped to support a healthy society. There was all of the infrastructure that's needed to support a healthy society were pre-planned and built into the Bourneville village. And so that would have been a form of socialism, but I don't think that the Cadbury family would have regarded themselves as socialist. They would have regarded themselves as sensible business people exercising what would be regarded as an enlightened form of capitalism, where you provide for your workers and you create an organized society that enables your workers to work as best they can for you. And other Quaker families did similar things. There was a Quaker, in fact, it wasn't a Quaker family, but there was a movement within the Labour Party that was reflected by this, the fact that there were these Quaker families. I know that Letchworth Garden City and the other garden cities that were created during the interwar period and the early post-war period, those garden cities followed a similar kind of theme, where they tried to create houses, and the post-war Labour government tried to create houses that were that provided the sufficient amenity and sufficient infrastructure to support the people that worked in them, so that they could therefore be expected to perform at their best when they were actually at work. And that is an enlightened form of capitalism, or you could call it an enlightened form of socialism. And that was the kind of thing that Henry Ford advocated. I mean, Henry Ford, when he started up his factories in 1914, doubled the rate of pay. So his workers were paid double, in fact, slightly more than double the average rate of pay for somebody in the motor industry. And so therefore, everybody that worked within easy reach of the Ford factories wanted to work for Ford because they would earn twice as much money. And so there was Henry Ford never had any problems recruiting people because they flocked to him because of the rates of pay that he provided. And he introduced profit sharing schemes that enabled the workers that worked hard to profit from the profits that were generated in the factories in which they worked. And all of this, it can be regarded as being an enlightened form of capitalism, if you want, or an enlightened form of socialism. But it was an attempt on the part of various people to create organized societies that were benevolent societies, that weren't doctrinaire Marxist or communist societies, but they were, as I say, benevolent societies that looked after their workers.
I should imagine that by this time, socialism had become tied up with Marxism, and that's what people were thinking of when they were thinking of socialism. They were thinking of Marxism and Bolshevism, so I should imagine he wanted to distance himself from that as well.
And where he says that he felt that humanity is not perfect enough to practice socialism, really what he's thinking of there, he's making the mistake of thinking of socialism as being international socialism. And because of his advanced age at this point, the fact that he's sort of perhaps getting into his 80s or whatever, and his, in my view, faculties perhaps aren't as sharp as they would have been before, making a mistake of thinking that a national-oriented form of socialism, a nationalist, a form of national socialism, could be spread around the world, which of course it can't do, because the world is divided into different nations, each of which have their own hopes and dreams, and all of which want to develop in their own particular way with their own cultures, etc. So you can't have a form of socialism that works for everybody in the world, and this is where, to some extent, I think Blatchford was influenced by the happy clappy kumbaya humanist form of socialism.
Well, when the first Labour government led by Ramsay MacDonald took office in 1924, Blatchford responded to Thompson's enthusiasm with, "I don't like their policy and I don't trust them. They are in no sense socialists. At present they are liberals, and we shall have a blend of liberal shibboleths and communist insanity." When Sir Edward Hulton sold most of his newspapers to Lord Rothermere, Blatchford wrote in a letter to the Morning Post, "As a protest against the attempt of the syndicated newspapers to muzzle the press and dictate to the government, I have resigned my position on the Sunday Chronicle and the Sunday Herald. The public should be helped to realise that the political judgments of the syndicated newspapers are not sincere and considered opinions of trained independent thinkers, but the broadcast railings of one rich man in a panic over the capital levy. It is important that this should be said, and that the country should understand that the voice of Lord Rothermere is not the voice of public opinion. His standardised newspapers are journalistic tied houses, where proprietorial dope is sold as honest beer." I mean, that's two very good opinions there. I mean, he's very suspicious of the Labour Party, is not supportive of the Labour Party, and he says that it's just going to be liberal shibboleths and communist insanity. And he understands here the dangers of the media being taken over by the oligarchs. And you've got a whole set of newspapers here, which is just going to become the mouthpiece of this Lord Rothermere.
Yeah, I think. And that is a perceptive point of view being expressed there by Blatchford. So
quite an early stage really. I mean, was that 1920s,
right,
to be suspicious of the newspapers at that time? I mean, we traced it as really sort of happening, what was it, about 1870, when they started really influencing the government and calling for General Gordon to go out there to the Sudan. I think that was about 1870, so about 50 years ago. And he's spotting it now in 1920, this influence that the media has started to have. And of course, it's so strong now that they literally manipulate the government. It's hard to tell where the media ends and the government begins nowadays.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, Blatchford eventually voted Conservative in 1924. However, his later books indicate a continued faith in his own English version of socialism. Moreover, the Clarion movement carried on as a socialist popular movement, taking its cue from Blatchford right into the 1930s and beyond, as indicated by the continued existence of the Clarion Rambling and Cycling Clubs and the founding of the newspaper The New Clarion in 1932. In a 1931 letter to Alexander Thompson, Blatchford proclaimed his last political credo, his language remaining fiery and eloquent, and he said, "I have always been a Tory Democrat. You remember that from the first the Clarion crowd and the Hardy crowd were out of harmony. I loathe the top-hatted, frock-coated, magnolia-scented snobocracy as much as you do. But I cannot away with the Keir Hardys and Arthur Hendersons and Ramsay MacDonalds and Bernard Shaws and Maxtons. Not long ago you told me in a letter of some trade union delegates who were smoking cigars and drinking whisky at the House of Commons at the expense of their unions. You liked them not. Nor do I like the trade union bigots who have cheated J.H. Thomas of his pension. I am glad the Labour Party is defeated, because I believe they would have disrupted the British Empire. I dreaded their childish cosmopolitanism, their foolish faith that we could abolish crime by reducing the police force. All the other nations are out for their own ends. American enthusiasm for naval disarmament is not dictated by love of peace. It is an expression of naval rivalry. All the nations hated our naval supremacy. Do the Americans love us? Do the French love us? Is France, America, Italy devoted to an unselfish and human peace? Can we dispel the bellicose sentiments of Russia and China and Japan by sending an old pantaloon to talk platitudes at Geneva, or by disbanding the Horse Guards and scrapping a few submarines? The England of my affection and devotion is not a country nor a people. It is a tradition, the finest tradition the world has ever produced. The Labour Party do not subscribe to that tradition, do not know it, could not feel it. And if that tradition is to survive, the policy of scuttle and surrender must be abandoned. You agree with all this, I feel sure. You always upheld the Pax Britannica. We have not drifted apart, old pal. Our separation is only geographical." And I find this interesting because he's pointing out that this drive from these other countries to get us to do things is not to our benefit. It's going to be to their benefit. And he says, how ridiculous to think that this American enthusiasm for naval disarmament is a love of peace. It's naval rivalry. It's because they want our navy to be weaker than their navy. And of course, this is what goes on with ethnicities. This is what goes on with races. And we're told now that, oh, no, everybody is the same. And these other ethnicities, when they come up with these ideas and they promote these ideas, it's all for our own good. And it's not. It's to their own good. And it's anything that weakens us as a nation is to a benefit of other nations. And if you're living in a multicultural nation, anything that weakens your ethnicity is to the benefit of the other ethnicities. And this is the constant competition that we see going on. And we see here where he identifies this, he understands that. And that means to me that everybody understood that back then. And it's just today that we don't understand this. I mean, it cannot just have been him that was pointing this out. And of course, we see that the Labour Party are the ones that are going along with this. They're the ones that are believing these ideas. And we would suggest that they just pretended to believe these ideas. And actually, they were really working to try and set up a new world order. They wanted to bring international communism in. I mean, that's why they would support the idea of weakening the Navy, is because they wanted to bring in internationalism. What do you make of what he has to say here, and the fact that he calls himself, what is it, a Tory Democrat? What do you think he means by that, Max?
I think he's got, this is one of the examples of where he's got himself a bit muddled in terms of what he's saying, because what he's failing to see, I mean, you're quite right in your observations you just made, that the individual nations will have their own self-interest, and individual ethnic groups will have their own self-interest within a multi-ethnic or multiracial society. But what Blatchford failed to fully appreciate, in my view, was the importance of race as a central tenet of the socialism that he espoused. And what's tended to happen is that as he's seen the Labour Party become corrupted by the communists and the Marxists and the crooked trade unionists, what he's seen, what he's done is he's turned away from socialism and decried socialism, thinking of it as an ideology that's too pure for the people to understand, when in reality he was trying to sort of advocate it at that point in time was as an ideology that didn't really serve the people's needs. But at the same time, instead of turning towards a proper national socialism, he is turning towards a sort of king and country kind of Tory version of patriotism, which uses all the same sort of patriotic platitudes and exhortations, etc., but is a form of politics where people don't actually mean what they say, and they're only just using words in order to deceive the public, and that was the perception that he failed to make there, in my view. But there again, Blatchford at the age of 43 was 49 plus 43, that's 92 years of age. So that's what I'm saying. I think Blatchford is a fantastic person from the point of view of the clarity of his thought, particularly in his early part of the 20th century. But then as the Second World War approached, and as he went through the Second World War, his clarity of thought wasn't quite as good as it might have been originally. And so he did say some things which don't entirely make sense nowadays.
Yeah, I mean, how could people continue a tradition if they were a different people? I guess he hadn't thought of that. I mean, when he was saying that his loyalty is to the tradition, the English traditions, rather than the English people. But if you don't have the English people or the British nations, you're not going to have those traditions. That they're just not going to continue. It's going to be the traditions of the different people that are living here. I mean, people groups have always emigrated all around the world, and they take their traditions with them. They don't take on the traditions of the people that they move into. I guess unless they're superior traditions, but then it's not really traditions. It's just a civilization. I'm thinking then of the Roman Empire, when peoples came into the Roman Empire. But of course, then that fell apart when you didn't have enough Romans in it. So I guess we can excuse him because he's getting on a little bit. And on 17th of December 1943, Blatchford died in Horsham, Sussex, at the ripe old age of 92. I mean, that is a good age to get to. Obviously, his views on healthy living and fresh air, they certainly did him some good, didn't they, to have him live to 92. Well, Blatchford's love of country themes were not a late aberration, but can be found throughout his output. His combination of libertarianism, socialism, and conservatism mark him out as one of the more original activists in English political history. The first Labour Chancellor of the Exchequer, Philip Snowden, said of Blatchford in his autobiography, "In these years, Mr. Blatchford gave invaluable help to socialist propaganda. No man did more than he to make socialism understood by the ordinary working man. His writings in them had nothing of economic abstruseness. He based his appeal on the principles of human justice. He preached socialism as a system of industrial cooperation for the common good. His arguments and illustrations were drawn from facts and experiences within the knowledge of the common people. Socialism, as he taught it, was not a cold, materialistic theory, but the promise of a new life, as full of sweet and noble as the world can give. Mr. Blatchford is still living, hale and hearty, his mental powers undiminished at the ripe age of 83. I saw him recently, and we talked of those grand and inspiring times of 40 years ago. Only the men who were in the socialist movement in those days can know the great part that Robert Blatchford took in making it popular, and of the personal devotion he inspired by his writings." So that was the first Labour Chancellor of the Exchequer, Philip Snowden, there. And of course, he was very critical of the Labour Party. So perhaps he was friends with this Philip Snowden that actually went on to join them. And you were saying, Max, that the Labour Party and the socialists today, that they try to forget Robert Blatchford and they don't talk about him that much, which is a great shame, really, that they try to ignore these people that actually came up with the idea of socialism in the first place, because it doesn't fit them today. It doesn't fit with their internationalist idea of it. I mean, he's pointing out here that it came from the knowledge of the common people and from talking [S2] Yes. [S1] To them and the experiences that he had as a common person.
Well, one of the most frustrating things that you can experience if you are a nationalist activist is doorstep canvassing during an election and finding somebody comes to the door who agrees with every single one of the policies advocated by the nationalist candidate standing in that area. But when you then ask them, well, can we count on your vote? They say, well, no, I think I'm going to carry on voting Labour because my father voted Labour and his father before him. And this is where... This is why the Labour Party don't want there to be any great analysis of Blatchford or his early writings. And that's just simply because it makes it obvious that the Labour Party today is nothing like the Labour Party was that Robert Blatchford helped to create. And it would then make stark in the minds of the people who still habitually support the Labour Party that, you know, what they're doing is ridiculous, and that it's not the name of the party that counts, it's the policies advocated by the party that counts. In fact, it's the policies implemented by the party that counts, because, you know, all too often we have conservative politicians who know exactly what the public want, but who say what they think we want them we want to hear, but then once they're in power, do the opposite, and the Labour Party do the same thing as well. And it's just so sad, really, that things have reached the kind of low ebb that they have. But, you know, there is hope for the future, and I think that particularly with the spread of our ideas on the internet and through programmes like this, where we talk about, you know, the way that people felt and the things that people used to say and believe in the past, that our ideas will spread and people will realise that the ideas of nationalism are the ideas that their forefathers struggled to establish, and the values and the principles that their forefathers struggled to establish and to promote. And there may be a tipping point at some point in the future. Hopefully there will be. And we will see a just government in this country.
I think it's also interesting that we see that he changed from being a socialist to being a Tory. And around about this time, he also had Oswald Mosley, who managed to work his way through, I think, the Liberals and the Labour Party and the Conservatives. And you can see that people were looking for something better than what there was already there. And they were trying to move into these parties and then trying to shape them in the way that they wanted, and they weren't able to. So Oswald Mosley started up his own party and his own group, and unfortunately with the Italian title of fascism, I think maybe he might have had more success if he'd come up with a British title for the party, even though it was still based on timeless principles, basically the fascist principles of everybody working together, which ties in with these socialist principles as well. Well, the General Secretary of the Trade Union Congress from 1925 to 1946, Sir Walter Citrine, was influenced by Blatchford's writings. He said of Britain for the British, "I found it a cogent and reasoned argument for socialism. It was written with a clearness and a bite which were unusual." Clement Attlee also spoke of Blatchford's influence on his beliefs, and A.J.P. Taylor said that Blatchford was the greatest popular journalist since Cobbett. So, I mean, he must have been a really good journalist. And even though he was critical of the trade unions, you've got the General Secretary of the Trade Union Congress talking highly of here. I would suggest a large part of the reason for why he was spoken of so highly is that he was a nationalist just as much as he was a socialist. In actual fact, his socialism flowed entirely from his nationalism, and his love for the English people. What are your final thoughts on Blatchford here, Max?
I would say that he's so well spoken of by various people within the Labour Party, to some extent because they actually admired his point of view, but also to some extent because they realised that when the public were exposed to Blatchford's writings, particularly the early writings during the early part of the 20th century, that they found them irresistibly logical, and so therefore a way of riding on the coattails of somebody that has got a great deal of popular appeal is to say nice things about them, even though you may not necessarily entirely agree with them in private. And I would suspect that some people that were prominent in the Labour Party, that particularly the ones that allowed Marxism and communism to permeate the Labour Party and allowed liberalism to permeate the Labour Party, those people probably didn't really agree with Robert Blatchford, and perhaps just mouthed platitudes in the hope that nobody would notice that they were opposed to what he advocated.
So really trying to latch on to his legacy, really, and make the most of that. Thank you very much for listening, and do watch out later in the year for more in our series on Greatest Britons.